From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection today was made 8 years ago in the midst of a tight presidential campaign. Illinois Senator Barack Obama held a narrow lead over New York Senator Hillary Clinton. But the Obama campaign was rocked by the release of videos showing Obama's pastor, Reverend Jeremiah Wright, saying incendiary things about the United States and its history with racial division. Obama decided he would deliver an address about race, his faith, and our country's future. The address was called A More Perfect Union, and he delivered it at the National Constitution Center in Philadelphia. It was a speech unlike any ever made by a presidential candidate, touching on racial tension, white privilege, and inequality. Obama, of course, went on to win the White House, and that speech is widely considered to be his best and most important. So today, 8 years later, we review the content of that address, we apply it to our own community. Where have we made progress? Where have we faltered in the intervening 8 years? In our first hour, we welcome elected leaders in our community. And let me welcome my guest now. Jim Shepard's here. He's a Monroe County legislator and former Rochester police chief. And James, nice to have you here.
Thank you for having me.
Van White's a Rochester school board member, the president of the Rochester school board. And Van, nice to have you as well.
Hey, Evan.
Simeon Bannister, Henrietta Democratic Committee leader here as well. Simeon, nice to have you.
Appreciate it.
Adam McFadden's a member of Rochester City Council. Adam, nice to have you as well.
In the building.
And we're aware that our panel for this hour is all male. Wasn't necessarily the intention. Mayor Lovely Warren had initially told us that she'd be able to join the panel, but we were informed last night she had to cancel due to a scheduling conflict, so it's certainly not intended to be all male, and we hope that our audience participation, listeners, you can call the program throughout the 2 hours today that we'll be discussing this subject and related subjects. You can also find us in social media, and we'll be working your comments in. But first, I want to listen to some of the president's remarks, kind of a part of the summation. Now, on our Twitter feed, we've posted video to the entire address that he gave in Philadelphia 8 years ago. Here is the president summarizing some of his feelings on race at the time.
This is where we are right now. It's a racial stalemate we've been stuck in for years. And contrary to the claims of some of my critics, black and white, I have never been so naive as to believe that we can get beyond our racial divisions in a single election cycle or with a single candidate, particularly a candidacy as imperfect as my own. But I have asserted a firm conviction, a conviction rooted in my faith in God and my faith in the American people, that working together, we can move beyond some of our old racial wounds, and that in fact, we have no choice. We have no choice if we are to continue on the path of a more perfect union.
So Barack Obama was saying 8 years ago, he didn't expect in one term, one election cycle, probably 8 years if you would have asked him then, that the deep and important divisions that he was addressing are going to be healed. But in talking to the members of this panel before the hour began, there was a sense that we are maybe even more segregated today than we were 8 years ago, that we have not really gone forward in a lot of the important ways that the president was talking about then Senator. Adam McFadden, are we more segregated now than we were 8 years ago?
Absolutely, and I think we've seen what I would call an Obama backlash that occurred after the president got in, that in the media you began to see people's fears play out. Even the way that they addressed issues of color, it was almost like we could never deal with them honestly. So I absolutely believe that we have gone backwards.
Simeon Bannister?
Well, let me just say very quickly that I was a little bit torn coming on today. My dad passed away recently.
I'm sorry to hear that.
I bring it up because this is an issue that was very, very close to my father's heart, particularly kind of broadly speaking race, and particularly within the context of Obama. And I would even go so far as to say that what I kind of take away from my dad and his teaching me on this, at least, is that we've got to be grounded in historicity, right? There are things that actually happen. I think we have a way of looking at race in a very linear fashion, right? We were here and now we're here, and how do we measure the distance that we've come? And in fact, we have to look at it in a multifaceted way, right? There's some places where we've made progress, no doubt, and there's certainly some very significant ways that we've had some retrogression. And I think it does us a real service to look at the kind of specificity and to examine this thing as closely as possible to be able to identify, again, where we've made progress, where we've gone backwards. But we can't look at it in a unilateral way, I think.
Okay. Jim Shepherd?
I think we definitely have not moved forward. We've had, like Simeon said, there's certain things we can say that people have moved a little bit. But if you look at, you know, Trump's campaign, it really brings out where people stand. And I think that for years we've sort of been comfortable keeping things in the closet. And I think through his campaign, people are willing to step up and say, you know what, this is how I really feel. And I think that's what's being exposed right now.
Hmm. Van White?
Well, Simeon talked about his father, so that made me think about my father, who died about 25 years ago. And he, too, was a person who's committed to Rochester. And I would agree with Simeon, not only in terms of looking at this from a personal perspective, what our fathers taught us, but what we saw when our fathers were here. And I think that compels us, at least compels me to say, some things are the same and some things are different. I mean, when my father was running the Carey Organization, which was an organization that sought to diversify Xerox, or when he was chair of the Urban League here in Rochester, at that time, you didn't have a city council that was predominantly people of color. Mm-hmm. You certainly didn't have a school board that was predominantly people of color. And so you got to acknowledge that change. And you certainly didn't have a president of the United States that was a president of color. But at the same time, those issues that my father was fighting against, and Simeon's father and other people in this room and their fathers and grandfathers, some issues they're still dealing with today. So I think we have to be a little more sophisticated in our assessment. But no doubt, there are some things that are very frustrating. There are some things that keep me in business as a lawyer because, and those are the things that people were suing about 20 years ago at companies throughout this community. So some things are the same and some things are better.
Let's get our first phone call in because I think it's a logical follow-up to Simeon's comments on having to acknowledge history, that things actually happened. And I want Drew in Rochester to go ahead with his question and comments for the panel, and then I think it's a good way to follow it up. Go ahead, Drew.
Just two things quickly. A question for the panel. In Jeremiah's speech, Reverend Jeremiah Wright's speech, in which he, according to the news media, in incendiary remarks, which the black community don't feel he made, do the panel think that Jeremiah Wright said anything wrong in his speech about the U.S. government and their involvement in wars around the world?
And Drew, I would just say, I don't have the full transcript here, you know, but Adam McFadden?
I've watched that speech, about three or four of his sermons,
yeah,
over and over again, and mm-hmm. I can tell you, if you watch them in their entirety, that he was factual in every point that he made, that he discussed. The sermon in particular where he said, "God damn America."
Yep.
He discussed the history, starting with the Dred Scott case, saying that that the Supreme Court said in 1856 that an African American, no matter if they were free or slave, did not have the right to bring charges against another person that was white. And he talked about how governments sometimes get it wrong and sometimes they get it right. And he talked about the things they got right, then he talked about the things they got wrong, and he was talking about the direction of where the government was going after Bush. And he said, according to the Bible that I serve, we can't be saying God bless America. We need to be saying God damn America because of these things. And he was absolutely right.
Because
and
of historical truths.
Yes. And I was actually disappointed in the president that he sought to separate himself from Jeremiah Wright because Jeremiah Wright didn't say anything wrong. Now, when you look at what Fox News attempted to do with the sermon, that they played that particular clip that sounded bad. But when you went back and listened to the whole thing, in my mind, Obama felt forced to go out there and say something to make white people feel comfortable. But what Jeremiah Wright said was actually correct. He didn't bring any personal. He gave actual facts about what this government has done to black folks, both good and bad. And his summation of that was, how could we be saying God bless America if they're doing these things? How could we say that? So I was disappointed that he had to go out and make the speech. Now, it was a great speech, But and at the same time, I didn't like the fact that he condemned basically the statements that were made. He actually, in my mind, gave us a soft speech to make other people feel comfortable. And that's the problem with race in this country, is that we have a right to discuss our pain. The problems that I face, that anytime that we voice our frustration, we're seen as being racist for telling our frustration.
Well, if I could just follow up to Adam's point there, I think some of what Senator Obama at the time said about Jeremiah Wright was that he wanted the audience to understand that much of the tirades you saw on the news, et cetera, the frustration was grounded in a broader context of history, oppression, that you're often not seeing the full sermon. And yes, then he went on to say, I don't agree with, you know, saying, God damn America. But at the same time, he said, this is a man who served his country, served in a uniform, and is looking at history. And by the way, after this speech, no less than Condoleezza Rice, hardly somebody who is going to politically align with Barack Obama, this is what she said. She didn't just say, hey, it was a good speech. Here's what I think was interesting. Here's what Condoleezza Rice said. She said, I think it was important that he gave it for a whole host of reasons. There is a paradox for this country and a contradiction of this country, and we still haven't resolved it. But what I would like understood as a Black American is that Black Americans loved and had faith in this country, even when this country didn't love and have faith in them. And that's our legacy. That's Condoleezza Rice's comments.
Yeah, I want to pick that up. If I could just read a couple of quick words. We know the I Have a Dream speech for the discussion with respect to content of character and so on and so forth. But I want to read this really quickly. When the architects of our republic wrote the magnificent words of the Constitution, Declaration of Independence, they were signing a promissory note to which every American was to fall heir. Yep. This note was a promise that all men, yes, Black men as well as white men, would be guaranteed the unalienable rights of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. I'm going to throw women in there, too. It is obvious today that America has defaulted on this promissory note insofar as her citizens of color are concerned. Instead of honoring this sacred obligation, America has given the Negro people a bad check, a check which has come back marked insufficient funds.
That's
right. Right?
And that's the part of the speech that nobody teaches our kids about.
And so the thing is that, you know, we've got, there's a tradition in the country, what we call the social Jeremiah tradition, right? You go back and actually, if you got some time, crack your Bible open and look at some of the things that prophets throughout the Bible said about Israel at any given moment. And these were prophets that were Israelite prophets, right? They were prophets of Israel. And they would describe in no uncertain terms where there was weakness and where their folks had strayed from the traditions, the sacred obligations, as King describes them in this speech. And so in many ways, Black preachers stand in that tradition. And they stand to say, wait a second, you know, there are things that are not right here. There are things that have gone askew. And there are things that there are incongruencies in terms of what our beliefs are and what our so-called higher angels say and what we actually practice in day to day. And I think that's really what we're seeing today. Again, we see progress. I mean, obviously, Van talked about the fact that we in our own city, we've got the mayor who's African-American, majority city council, folks in the county legislature, so on and so forth. At the same time, in our own community, we've got a guy who said that, you know, Black people were not welcome in the town of Henrietta, right? So, you know, these are the kinds of challenges
that we've got. And he got reelected. He said our cousins.
City cousins. Yeah. And he got reelected easily.
As an African-American walked towards the door and he got reelected easily. And I only wonder, right, I can only wonder, I saw something popped up on my phone today that the Trump folks are scouting our area for a rally to take place here, you know, somewhere in proximity. And so I can only wonder, you know, in our own community, the folks that go out there. Again, we have to look at the history. See, maybe get into this in a little bit. But if you look at presidential cycles historically, there are some very, very interesting trends that emerge. And Trump is appealing to a very similar cadre of folks that George Wallace appealed to, and not just in the South, which is, you know, often right. Lost on history.
Yep. Let's listen to another clip from that address by President Obama. And again, if you're just joining us, 8 years ago this week, he made the address in Philadelphia, A More Perfect Union. This is him talking about segregated schools, because our panel agrees we are even more segregated than we were 8 years ago when he was making these remarks. And they come from various parts of our community. We've got a town Democratic leader. We've got a city council member. We've got the president of a school board. We have a county legislator and a former police chief. So let's listen to what the then Senator Obama said, and we're going to ask What is the government's function? What is our community's function in starting to change this? This is him on segregated schools.
Segregated schools were and are inferior schools. We still haven't fixed them 50 years after Brown versus Board of Education. And the inferior education they provided, then and now, helps explain the pervasive achievement gap between today's black and white students.
All right, Van White, 8 years ago, the president says that. No one has to kind of go down the list of Rochester statistics, so everybody knows that the city school district has had struggles with graduation rates and many other things here. Why haven't we been able to see widespread improvement?
Well, poverty is one reason. You know, I was saying to somebody this morning that it is so easy to say to the district you failed and not take any responsibility for their part in the failure. I mean, we are one of the poorest communities in the nation. The district doesn't create that poverty, right? And there's so many things that go along with that poverty, like, for example, lead poisoning. Most of our housing stock, a considerable part of our housing stock, was painted prior to 1970. And anybody who knows anything about lead poisoning is once that stuff gets in your system, it creates permanent behavioral and intellectual deficits and struggles for children. So I think that's part of the problem. I also think, looking to the district, I was saying to somebody else this morning that whenever you lower expectations, there's a corresponding reduction in accountability. So over the decades, people said, oh, well, you know, they have problems with dysfunctional homes and problems with poverty and problems with lead and problems with jobs and broken families. And each time the bar was lowered in terms of expectations for our children, the people responsible for those children, not just the teachers and the principals, but parents and mayors and school board members, all received a corresponding discount, reduction in their level of accountability. So the less you expect of your children, the less you expect of the people responsible for them. And again, that could be parents, teachers, school board members, mayors. So we got to a place over decades where we didn't expect much from our children, and therefore we didn't expect much from the people who we paid or who we expected to provide for them. Only more recently have we begun to have a dialogue about, wait a second, the fact that we have struggles doesn't give you a pass, principal or mayor or school board member. You have a legal and ethical and indeed a moral obligation to provide for kids. I think we're getting better at that. So I was just saying to somebody this morning, and nobody wants to hear all this detail, but when you have increased accountability, we've never done this as a district. For the last 2 years since I've been president, we literally, 7:30 every Friday morning, we are at our schools meeting with principals. Yes, it's the superintendent. In the past, we met with the superintendent and his or her staff at central office. Now, every Friday morning at 7:30, we meet with principals. We go from school to school to school, and we ask them about, we developed a form. It's called the Finish Line Report. Where are you at with your graduation rate? Where are you at with your ELA scores, your math scores, your suspension rates, your attendance rates? Where are you at with your growth scores? That is the agenda. We are asking principals directly what they are doing. And the reason why we're doing that, we want them to understand they are accountable. I think that conversation wasn't taking place for decades. And that's just one example of how the accountability conversation is now taking place. You do not get a pass because we have poverty. Poverty is an explanation, but it's not an excuse.
Okay. Jim?
I want to say that in terms of, and we talked before we went on air about the suburban, urban problem in terms of people moving to the suburbs. And that's where you see your finer schools. I mean, you go to Pitcher Sutherland, they're like ranked number one in the state. So it indicates that that economic disparity does have an impact. And I think it also has a cultural impact, because when you have that concentration of poverty, maybe you don't look at education as the way out. You don't look at it as necessarily the means of how you're going to be successful. How you define success is a little bit different than somebody who's living in a neighborhood where everybody's doctors, lawyers, and Indian chiefs. And so I think that in terms of that issue of the city schools, what you find is that a lot of our kids don't look at the people around them and say, that's my model, that's my role model. Or they do look at the people around them and say, that's my role model, so they don't try to achieve. And I think that you ask, how can we fix the problem? You know, one way is to go to a countywide school district, because once you relieve this concentration of poverty and this concentration of minorities in a small geographical area, they can also learn from the people around them as well.
I don't know too many people. Well, I could be wrong, but I've heard a lot of people who agree that a Wake County, North Carolina kind of set up a countywide school district would have been a great idea, and that ship sailed about 30 years ago, and this 20 districts in this county will never stand for that. That's what I hear, Jim. I mean, do you think it's even viable to talk about that kind of thing?
The conversation was, I think, about 16 years ago there was a conversation. Obviously, it was a part of an election for county exec, and he failed miserably relative to taking that stance. But I think, you know, when you look at some of the issues relative to Unite Rochester and people talking about some of the things that we need to do as a community as opposed to just, you know, African Americans need to do this or that, I think we're moving in a direction where people say, you know what, we have to do something. And whether that's the cure or not, I don't know. But I think that we're moving in a direction where people are looking at it and saying, you know what, we can't just stand on the sidelines and just watch this go on.
Okay, Ben?
Let me just say, I don't disagree with anything Jim said, but somebody else can do that. I'm not even thinking about that. I am bold enough, bad enough to believe that our students, our parents, our teachers, our administrators can and must do better. And so we're bold enough to believe that we have people and collaboratives in this community. That's why we did, the board led the initiative to get the U of R to run East High School, because we believe we have the resources within our own community. And resources include the University of Rochester, which is the number one employer in this region, right? So imagine having a high school. Imagine having a high school where you can go there and think about becoming a doctor, a surgeon, a lawyer. The U of R is that pathway. So I think while people may say concentrated poverty needs to be broken up and we need to look at the suburbs as an opportunity to do that, I think you're absolutely right. Bill Johnson's election was a reflection of the fact that people resoundingly reject that. And I say to people, I'm not spending any time on doing it because I have the boldness to believe that we can accomplish this on our own. And people say, well, what are you guys doing with this military academy? I believe these charter schools are creating innovative ideas. I have the gall to believe that we have the resources and the inspiration to create those models within the city limits because we have the people and the capacity to do that. I think that's what we have to do. We have to begin to believe that we, as a people, the city of Rochester, African Americans, Caucasians, can accomplish this. And I think that has been missing because I go back to this issue of expectations. People have been beaten down so much they don't believe it's possible. You gotta begin to believe that you can actually make it happen.
Yeah, I also think it's a matter of courage, right? And a matter of being willing to kind of stand up and speak the truth and say the truth. So for example, I harken back to our previous conversation about progress and retrogression, right? There is progress that has been made in this community to the extent that we are having a very real conversation about poverty, right? And a conversation that's being led by institutional power in this community, particularly the government. That is progress in Rochester, right? That means something. Conversely, right, I would say that there's some retrogression in certain kinds of ways that we're talking about poverty. So, for example, when I look at a lot of the discussion, there's been a lot of focus on what poor people need to do, right? The skills that they need to acquire, the education that they need to acquire, what they need to do to be able to get, quote, middle skills jobs. And certainly there's some conversation that is important to have in that vein. What I have not heard is a conversation about hiring bias in our community, right? That you get the skills, you go to school, you get everything that you need to have to get a job, and then you can't get a job, right? And then when you look at, particularly in the executive level in our community, you don't see that diversity reflected. That's just the truth, right? And we've got to start being able in our community to speak the truth.
How do you fix that, Simeon?
Well,
hiring bias.
Sure. I think a big part of it, number one, I would hope that the initiative starts to do some very real training, and certainly you can't compel folks in the private sector to attend, but certainly to provide them some opportunities on what it looks like to recruit in urban communities, right? To recruit in the city, what it looks like to hire folks that are able to bring a different perspective. Another thing I'd love to see is a conversation emerge with respect to photonics. A very real conversation about what those jobs look like. I mean, we saw in the city of Buffalo this conversation around the Solar City plant that was built. But there, the Solar City jobs program that was created in East Buffalo completes for trainees. They don't finish the program until many of the jobs would have already been hired, right? So, I mean, you get the okey-doke. And so we want to have an honest discussion, an honest discourse here about how folks get those opportunities. And more importantly, it seems to me that we really need to be focused on entrepreneurship in this community. And so that it's not just a question of how folks get jobs, but how folks are able to create jobs and how folks are able to build businesses. And I think if we kind of build some of that focus in and really kind of, you know, compel people to do that, I think we can make some very real progress. At the same time, we also need to enforce laws that are on the books with respect to hiring discrimination. And I was very heartened to see the governor's new piece with housing discrimination and some of the work that they're doing there. So, you know, there are options that we have available to us. The question, again, is do we have the courage? Do we possess the fortitude and the will to actually start standing up and saying this?
All right, let me let the same councilman, Adam McFadden.
I agree with everything everyone said, but I want to go back to education. We have to put into our young people the hunger to strive for excellence. And to me, a kid that's hungry for knowledge, hungry for education, can survive any bad situation, any obstacle we put in their way. The problem is we have weakened our children to think that violence is strength, that being smart is not, going to school is not, but hanging out with my boys is. We have to figure out how it is that we tap into the minds of young people and give them an option so that they become their biggest advocate. Right now, everyone is trying to tell them what to do. No one has instilled in them that it's important for them to figure it out themselves. So we had this Black College Fair last year. Sadly enough, we got limited coverage on it. You had 1,000 African American and Latino kids at the convention center, most of them from the Rochester City School District, who received on the spot almost $1.4 million. A bunch of kids accepted into college, and we got very little coverage. Now, we don't do this for coverage, but what that said to me was people claim they want to see African Americans be educated. They want them to succeed, but then when it comes time to show that picture, that's not the picture they want to show. Matter of fact, that night, I got a call from the news station about doing an interview. I thought they wanted to talk about the college fair. It was about a shooting. And I said, how dare you ask me about a shooting and not ask me about this college fair that had 1,100 kids, $1.4 million given out in scholarships to Black kids in our area. And that thing has spawned on to do some great things for families that Van will never get the credit for, I will never get the credit for, the mayor will never get the credit for, and we don't care about that. But it's starting to plant a seed and a path out of poverty. See, we have to begin to construct this road that people can get on the road without being told what to do, that they just follow the path out of poverty. We keep trying to figure out, as Simeon said, what poor people should do. If we look back in our own family history, when you think about poverty, my mother's family was sharecroppers in South Carolina. They didn't do all of these things that poverty caused people to do now. What they said, hey, if you want to get out of these fields, you better go to school. That was the avenue out. And so when I became a student, no matter how well I did, my mother told me the same message. You're skating on thin ice. I could have a B in a class, and she would be riding me about getting an A. She wasn't the most educated person in the world, but it was instilled in her as a little girl that education was important. We do not have families who believe that anymore. That's why we're facing what we're facing. I could care less about the segregation because we had segregated schools back then with one classroom and limited books, and we were able to survive that. So you're telling me with all of the facilities in the world, all the money in the world, all of the opportunities in the world that we can't learn how to read, write, and do math? Somebody's got to explain that to me.
So, and what prompted this conversation was the Senator Obama's speech in 2008. But if you go back to 2004, the speech that launched him to prominence was at the Democratic National Convention. And during that speech, I don't know it word for word, but he essentially said, we need to change the scenario in this country where a Black kid with a book is acting white. Has that changed in 12 years?
I want to comment on what Adam said about the education piece and growing up. Because I know for me, and having lived in the South, that was like the key to moving forward. I mean, I used to get phone calls and letters from my grandparents and great aunts saying, what are your grades like? What are you doing? And giving me little Black history newspapers from Atlanta so that you knew the history and you knew that was your way out. My father worked over there across the street at Kodak office. He never had a high school diploma. He had to write reports that I wrote for him while I was in high school. And so that instilled in me that, you know, to be successful, you had to, you know, go get that education piece. And I think that, you know, you said 2004, Obama said a lot of African-American kids do believe that, you know, if I'm studying, if I'm doing well in school, I'm not sticking with my blackness, and we need to change that.
But you know, there's a lot of conversation that happens internal to our community. It's interesting, whenever I hear these kinds of conversations come up about, you know, racial dialogue and all that kind of stuff, and I hear, you know, some of my friends, white friends, and they say, well, gee, you know, instead of these people out here protesting about people getting murdered by the police, they ought to be protesting about, you know, black-on-black crime. See, that happens every day, right? Like, that happens literally, like, every day, right? Mm-hmm. That is happening on a consistent basis within African-American communities. You know, again, it goes back to the question of historicity, right? Things actually happen. Do you know that in the turn of the 20th century, there were communities all over the United States of America that were segregated black communities that were financially well off?
That
places like
prosperous.
Hayti and Durham,
yes.
You know, places like
Tulsa,
like in Tulsa, T-Town, right? Yeah. And these places were literally destroyed by outside, you know, quite frankly, purveyors of violence, right? Tulsa, they literally dropped a bomb in Tulsa, right? Durham and Hayti, Durham, North Carolina, they put a highway through the middle of that community. Mm. Our own Clarissa Street, right, here in Rochester. And so, you know, the question then becomes, again, there are things that have historically happened that have cut off the African-American community at the knees as we've attempted to achieve the American dream, right? The drugs, I mean, come on. You know, the chief obviously can talk about this. I mean, the impact of drugs in our community cannot be understated. And when we talk about, you know, the values of education, we talk about the values of, you know, those aunts and uncles. Well, you know, what happens is when you start getting a lot of these aunts, uncles, and so on and so forth that get strung out, that creates some real problems, right? And I think we've underestimated, you know, the damage that wrought. So we've got Obama here. He offers this speech, right, offers this prescription for some things that we ought to be thinking about. At the same way that we have to understand the historicity, you know, kind of quote on our side, you know, and pardon the tribalistic language there, we also have to appreciate the dynamics that are happening in Caucasian communities, which I think I, you know, at least attempt to understand, right? Which is that you have some folks that don't feel a responsibility for slavery, right? There's some folks that don't feel a responsibility for, housing discrimination and bias. And they say, well, gee, what? I'm not biased. I don't have anything. I don't have a problem with, you know, with anyone. And so we've got to, again, you know, start to tinker with this thing a little bit to help people to see how the habits that they take, you know, continue to reinforce what's in place. Just very quickly, in another example of this, you know, on one hand, a lot of us are complaining. So this just to completely recontextualize, a lot of people are complaining about jobs right now, right? We need to bring jobs back. We need jobs in this country. We want Donald Trump or, you know, Bernie Sanders or whoever, because they said they're going to bring jobs back and all that kind of stuff. Yet those same people get up and go and shop at Walmart, right? You see, these are incongruencies, right? There's an incongruent pattern that we have in our country that we need to wrestle with, I think, a little bit more. And we see it in a lot of different areas. And I think if we have the, you know, the willingness and sophistication to start having truthful conversations with one another, but then not just stop at conversations, right? Not just stop at talk, but then to start turning that into real action, then hopefully we can actually start to make some progress.
All right, so I'm way late for a break, and we'll continue with our panel in just a second, and we'll get to some of your phone calls, and the phones are lit up here. It's 8 years since the president's address on race in Philadelphia, called A More Perfect Union. We're reviewing the contents of that address and where the country has gone in the intervening 8 years with the members, elected leaders in our community. You just heard Simeon Bannister from the Henrietta Town Democrats, Adam McFadden from Rochester City Council, Van White, president of the Rochester City School Board, and Jim Shepard, former Rochester Police Chief and now a Monroe County legislator. Some of your phone calls and more of their comments next on Connections. Coming up in our second hour, we continue our discussion and our look back at President Obama's speech on race in Philadelphia 8 years ago. We'll bring in community members, people who work in various parts of our area, working with kids, working with students, working with impoverished communities, working with criminal defendants. We'll talk to people from very different parts of Rochester and Western New York next hour.
The fight over Confederate symbols in the Old South is heating up in Mississippi. A new federal lawsuit says the state flag is unconstitutional.
The flag with that emblem is a vestige of slavery.
Take it down! Take it down!
When you're asking me to take it down because those people were so bad, those people were my ancestors.
Heritage or hate? Later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
This afternoon at 4 on WXXI.
Welcome back to Connections. That tease for the story on All Things Considered. pretty remarkable in the context of what we're talking about. Let me get some phone calls. Joan and Hilton. Go ahead, Joan.
Yeah, hi, guys. I kind of tuned in the middle. I know it's Adam McFadden, and I'm not sure who the other person is, but I really admire what you're talking about. And I just wondered if other studies have been done, because I know other schools have been very successful. I saw a show on the Ginn Boys from the, you know, football player that started at school. I heard one just the other day, I think, on NPR in Detroit, 100% graduated, 100% are going to college. And these are in poor neighborhoods, difficult areas. And I'm sure New York City's had some successes. I would think we could just emulate them and, you know, solve this problem. Because I agree with you guys. There's no excuses. I don't, you know, everybody says, oh, it's the parents. Well, it's just we can't accept that. We just got to go forward some other way.
Joan, thanks for the phone call. My concern with the no excuses mentality is there's a little bit of a, and I'm not accusing Joan of this, and I'm not saying that Van is advocating this, but for white people, the more you hear no excuses, that's a good way for people in the suburbs to say, see, they'll fix it, no excuses, you know, and we stay segregated. But I also understand that you've got to be able to walk and chew gum at the same time. You got to say no excuses, but we all have to understand our history and link arms a little bit. So, Van, what do you think of what you're saying about works elsewhere?
I think you don't even have to look elsewhere. We have some models that actually work in Rochester. We just don't talk about them a lot.
Like?
School Without Walls graduates in excess of 80% of their kids on time. Their special ed kids, over 90% of their kids on time.
Do they have less poverty?
No. Same demographic, okay. Same demographics.
Right. So what's different? What's working there?
Well, they don't have the rigorous performance tests that other schools have, right? There are performance-based analysis of what they do. The environment is sort of expeditionary. They get to go out in the community and learn about the community and grow from that. Additionally, School Without Walls graduates, I think, 80% of their kids on time. So I think it's important that we understand that we can replicate best practices here in our own community. We have elementary schools that work really well. 58, same demographics, World of Inquiry. So I think it's important that we begin to replicate approaches that work. And I also think it's important that we think out of the box and do some stuff differently, like we did at East High School in the U of R. Like we're contemplating, I haven't talked about it yet, we've got another EPO agreement probably going to be announced shortly that's going to develop some best practices at the elementary school level. So at East, we're developing best practices at the secondary level, which other schools can replicate. And we're going to hopefully announce shortly an elementary school EPO so that other district schools can replicate that. But I want to go back to something else both Simeon and Adam said in terms of accountability for elected officials or responsible officials. You know, Adam talked about it's called the Empowerment Tour.
Empowerment Tour.
So here's where, you know, I talk about the fact that when my father was coming up, there wasn't a black mayor. I don't know how many people were on city council, probably not many, certainly probably very few people on the school board. When we do get in these positions, Jim is on the county ledge. I don't know other than Constance Mitchell, who was on there, but probably few people of color. Here's the connection between the creating the jobs and the creating the hope. Once we get these jobs, we got to do something with it. So Adam went out there. I know he wasn't the only one. He's too humble to say this, but he went out there. He saw an opportunity to get hundreds of kids, thousands, maybe millions, hundreds of thousands of dollars in scholarships, right? So that their lives would be better, right? I still am a lawyer. When I got on the school board, I was tired of suing people for discriminating against grown men and women of color and women just generally. So when I got on the school board, I said, wait a second, why are we giving contracts to, our district was giving millions and millions and millions of dollars to people, a roofing company that regularly was discriminating against people of color, putting black men on the roofs of buildings across this country, making millions, across this county, making millions of dollars. And yet the EEOC was saying they were discriminating against people of color. And as a lawyer, I would sue them and get those determinations. But then when I got on the school board, I'm like, well, wait a second, this same company is getting millions of public dollars. Why are we allowing them to do that? So as a decision maker, like Adam, I said, I'm going to do something with it. So do you now know that we passed a policy, which is like a board law, that if you have an outstanding, a pending EEOC decision or human rights decision as an employer that says that you've discriminated against women, people of color, Asians, whatever, you cannot get a district contract. So there's a nexus between those people that were missing when our parents were coming up and those people now being in positions. We can create the jobs that
did not exist before. So you know, we often talk about, oh, well, this happened and this happened. But here is where we are making our history. You got elected. Do something with it. And I think on the school board, we're creating new school opportunities. We're even addressing the issue of jobs. Adam he's on city council, but he's creating opportunities for people to get educated. There is a connection between the suffering of adults and the work of people who are now in a position to do something about it.
Van, you mentioned charter schools earlier this hour. Yes. Gary writes to us and says, can the panel comment on the criticism that charter schools are the new face of school segregation? Is that unfair as a characterization?
Well, I'll be very brief. Generally, what's happening is parents are going where they see an opportunity to have an improved educational opportunity. And so, you know, and those are black folks, too. Those are white folks. They're going there. Those are people of means in the city, and there are people without means that are going to these charter schools. And here's my thing. It's about accountability. We can sit here and watch those people leave and watch our school district hemorrhage, our traditional public schools lose the money that is going with them, or we can do something about it. And so we created the U of R EPO. I don't know what's going to happen with this military camp, but let me tell you something. All these people that are going to charter schools, I believe, this is what I believe. I don't know what the rest of my colleagues believe. I believe if we create a military academy, a lot of these people that are leaving will say, I can't get that no place else. I'm staying here in this district. So it's about creating opportunities. That's what the charter schools have done. Parents are going to those opportunities, whether they're rich or poor, black or white. And we have to, as decision makers, we got an opportunity now. Right? We got an opportunity. We got to create the opportunities for other people.
But then we also, again, stand in courage, right? So we saw Justin Murphy's story about the Discovery Charter School and all the, you know, craziness around that situation, you know, in many ways milking public dollars by many players that are involved in the county government. And so that's, again, you know, to Van's point, that it's important for us to then stand up and to voice that and to identify concrete proposals, different ways things that we can put in place that allow us to be able to resolve those kinds of issues, bring some grievance and some redress to those issues, right? I mean, if we've got folks that are making millions and millions of dollars on the backs of our children, there is a fundamental problem there, right? And if it's the same people that were involved in, you know, siphoning millions and millions and millions of dollars out of county government, there's a big problem there. And so, again, we got to stand up and kind of speak that truth and look for ways to, you know, antagonize folks that have not been willing to engage in the kind of progressive, and I don't say that with not the loaded progressive term, but I mean as in moving forward, as in progressing us forward, that are not willing to engage in a progressive process, particularly when it comes to government.
Okay, charter schools. Jim, anything else you want to weigh in?
I think when we talk about charter schools, what you see is a lot of parents who really care about their children's educations are making those decisions to send their kids to charter schools. And that is a segregation because you also have kids in these city school districts that maybe their parents aren't as involved or maybe they're not as engaged in making sure that their kids get an education. And so you're just basically concentrating it even further. I think this charter school experiment, we went through this through parochial schools. That's what I look at. There's a reason there's no parochial schools in the city. It's because when it no longer was profitable, they chose to close those schools. And so I think that you're going to see the same thing happen with charter schools, where as the profit is no longer there, they no longer have a purpose for doing what they do. We talked earlier about the chess game versus the checker game. And that's what I see is that in terms of the charters, it's a chess game, seeing where you can pull those public dollars and put your schools together, and you can show success because, you're getting parents that are engaged and kids that want to get an education, and you show you got your great scores. But there's going to come a time where that's no longer going to be a moneymaker, and you're going to see those schools start to dry up.
But that doesn't necessarily have to be a conflict between, doing well financially and educating our young people, right? So I want to be clear about that, right? I would not argue that folks need to, do this at a loss, right? I mean, certainly I can appreciate that. But when you are not actually fulfilling the mission of educating our children, when we look at the test scores that come out of some of these schools and they don't actually demonstrate achievement, but you're still cashing those checks, then we've got a big problem there, right? And I would differentiate the two. I think, and certainly if we've got places that are offering a great, quote unquote product, and I don't know, if that's the best way to talk about education, but if they offer a great product that parents can certainly, vote with their feet and, get those kids involved and all that stuff, I don't have any problem with that. But I do think that there's an issue when somebody's making, lots and lots of money and there's no discernible progress that happens for these young people.
And what I'm hearing from Van is that the district should be competing like anyone else. And that's a different message from when charter schools were first popping up. Mm-hmm. They were saying, woe's me, we're mm-hmm. losing kids.
Right.
Now you hear the board saying, we have to compete for these kids. What can we do to get them back? Right. And I think that's a step in the right direction, yep. because parents will make the best choice for their children, whether it's paying right. Tuition like I do, mm-hmm. or if mm-hmm. it's going to a public option or, mm-hmm. or charter school. Either way, parents are going to find the best possible option for their child.
All right, trying to keep it moving here. Alex just writes to us and says, I'm pretty sure that 8 years ago when the president made his speech, police relations were better than they are today, particularly among white police officers and African Americans. And we have a former police chief here. Hey, Jim Shepard's got a big smile. I know this is a whole other hour. It's a whole other day of discussion. But Jim, yesterday, Michelle Norris, a longtime NPR correspondent, was here. She created something called the Race Card Project. She said one of the more powerful six-word descriptions of race she got was hated for being a white cop. She said that stayed with her. To keep reminding her that there's a lot of great white police officers who feel that tension and they feel hated when they go out. And at the same time, as you got Alex and people writing to us saying that the African-American community feels targeted in some ways here. Eight years ago to today, have we gone backwards?
I don't think we've gone backwards. I think we've highlighted some of the flaws that you see in policing. You know, in my career, I think that I've felt the hate and I felt the love at the same time. I think one of the things that I think stands out for me is the fact that 8 years ago, as a policeman, people were more inclined to engage and have those conversations and your community meetings and work with the police. And we went through a period where that no longer was in play. I think we're coming back to it now because of some of the things that have been highlighted, especially over the last 2 years with what happened in Missouri or what happened in Baltimore, what happened in New York. And that's the way to move the agenda forward. One thing that jumps out at me, and I think Simeon had mentioned earlier about with drugs, and I never thought of it during my career in terms of drug enforcement. I don't think it was like we're enforcing drugs because we want to put black people in jail. But what is occurring currently, particularly with, you know, heroin and opiates, you're seeing there's a different way people want it addressed. Because, you know, in my career, and I worked narcotics, it was about locking them up and putting them in jail mm-hmm. and clearing them corners. And now you're seeing, particularly with the opiates and overdoses and the rural areas being inundated, they're saying, you know, why don't we have a house where they can go to and shoot up and have a nurse there so that they don't OD. And
I mean,
it's a different approach.
That's what Ithaca's doing right now, right?
They put it on the table, and the question was asking me, and I said, you know what? Whether he's right or wrong, we will be there. We will get there because of who's being affected.
At the very least, I think what Jim's saying dovetails with what we've heard from Secretary Clinton on the campaign trail, which is very different rhetoric than what we saw 20 years ago when she was talking about so-called super predators, increasing incarceration, treating drugs as just a criminal problem as opposed to, you know, so anyway, Jim, you want
to... The one point I wanted to make about law enforcement is I think that we have been burdened with being the cure, and we did not have the tools to be the cure for what ails mm-hmm. particularly urban environments.
Simeon?
Yeah, and I was going to say, and so that's progress, what you described with, you know, Senator Clinton, right? That is progress, right? That is evolution, and people are allowed to do that. People are allowed to have one opinion 20 years ago, and they certainly, we would hope that they would evolve over those 20 years. During that same 20 years, right, I have this little device in my pocket called an iPhone, okay? And that iPhone was then emulated by Samsung and so many others, all right? And folks, and there's been a proliferation of these devices so they can capture on film what we saw in 1992 as an example with the Rodney King situation, which I assume was taken with a bulky, you know, camera, right? And so, you know, there are a lot of these issues that have been, you know, kind of going on for, I think, a long time, you know? And certainly, we know that in the Nader period in this country in the 20s, we saw the proliferation of lynchings and all that kind of stuff. And so, you know, the violence has gone away. At the same time, nobody, and I think this is where we get into these false conversations, nobody that I know that is sane and rational would argue that all police are bad. Nobody's making that argument, right? Nobody's saying that every single police officer is a terrible police officer. I know tons sitting across the table from me, obviously, but I know tons of police officers, white, black, Asian, Latino, so on and so forth, that are wonderful cops, right? And they do a great job. And oh, by the way, communities of color, black community, in this particular case, We want cops, okay? We want to be safe and we want to be protected. We just also want to be respected. Okay. And I think that's what it kind of comes down to.
All right, 30 seconds. Adam McFadden, are you an optimist that 8 years from now, you're not an optimist?
I'll put it this way.
Does it depend on November?
I don't think it has anything to do with the presidency for me, because I think what we're seeing, I already knew existed. So it wasn't a revelation for me to see this type of rhetoric coming out of the campaign. I think what we have to talk about is 40 years from now, not eight.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's probably well said. And sometimes we all like overnight results here. The president, maybe we should heed his words from 8 years ago. Not one campaign, not one presidency is going to change everything. And maybe that expectation was silly.
But Evan, the Supreme Court can.
Well,
and I just want to get that in before
you just
before
opened
we close.
Up a whole other.
Evan, let me get this in there. I am optimistic, very optimistic. Because
in 8 years,
in 4 years, in 2 years, I am very. This is recorded, right?
Yeah.
I am very optimistic.
I just want to say that I think that Obama's original speech in 2008 was surgical. It was an incision. It solved the cancer that was killing this country, and he gave us some options on how to address it. And I think what we see now with the Trump thing, it's somebody just reached into your body, they took that cancer, and they're massaging it and making it come more to life.
We'll see. That's Jim Shepherd, Van White, Adam McFadden, Simeon Bannister. Thank you all for being here. Short break. Other community leaders join us as we continue the discussion next hour.